The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy, and how you can make the most of your own life, right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. Welcome again to my hour. Today we're going to be talking about meditation, we're going to be talking about spirituality, we're going to be talking about psychotherapy, and really maybe adventuring into some areas that can be difficult to understand, confusing to understand, and really are on the edge of our relationship between ourselves, other people, nature, God, and the universe. My deepest interest in recent times has been empathy. Empathy is about connecting to other human beings in a special way. There's the empathy of simply knowing what somebody is saying, having a grasp of it. There's the empathy of feeling what someone else is feeling, including even suffering with them. There's the empathy of being caring and loving and feeling another person's situation without suffering, which is key to psychotherapy, to be able to feel ourselves in another's position and to bring love and caring to it. There's also an empathy that is deeply spiritual, that gives us a sense of being connected not just to the other person, but to nature, to God. And that's probably the most controversial and the most interesting aspect of empathy, the way it connects us. I think if we feel genuinely empathic toward another human being, then we're going to feel a greater sense of connection to the universe, to other human beings, to animals. I don't think empathy can be limited. I don't think it can be narrow. I don't think it can be specific, because I think it's a willingness on our own part to open our heart and soul to another human being, and therefore really to life itself, to all of life. This is an important concept for me because it guides how I feel at most peace and really most in touch with the world around me. It's when I'm willing to accept what's there, to understand what's there, to participate when I can in a loving and in a caring manner. Now, I'm not sure if my guest has arrived yet.
Hello?
Hello? Is that Don?
I'm here.
Is that Don?
Yes, it is. Hi.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. My guest today is Don Salmon, spelled S-A-L-M-O-N. Let me tell you a little bit about him before we bring him on to the show. We've never met. Been drawn to things that he's communicated to me on our network originally, then talking with me and my wife. For it looks like a quarter century just about, Don was a composer, performer, a teacher, worked as a musician. He made a very interesting comment to me on an email about how when you're improvising music and improvising dance with another person together, that it's a kind of a really fine-tuned empathy. Eventually, Don decided to get a master's degree in psychology, and he went to West Georgia College, which I hope we'll talk a little about, which is a very humanistic setting, one of the few in the country. And then he decided to do the hard knocks of a regular PhD, which he took at Long Island University. Now, he's done work in a variety of areas as a psychotherapist. In the earlier days, he worked with developmentally disabled adults, and I want to hear some from him about that, and had some similar experiences to the ones I had as a college student, and realizing how much with a caring approach, a loving approach, you could really reach people, even people called psychotic, without drugging them, coercing them, bullying them. He has a private practice of therapy, and he's a meditation teacher. And in addition to that, he does some very nuts and bolts stuff that I think is quite controversial that we could talk about as well, which he does disability determinations, which is perhaps, in some ways, one of the more down-to-earth psychological services that you can provide. And I'm hoping, Don, that today we'll sort of be able to work our way on the around some of the edges of creativity and music and art and theater and your feelings about all that and how it led you into psychology and now into meditation. Any starting thoughts, Don Salmon?
Yes. Well, first, thank you so much for having me on. I've been an admirer of your work for years, and I think I'd like to say that perhaps you inspired me in different settings where I was able to help people reduce or even get off medication. I'd think of the psychiatrists or doctors who were skeptical of what I was doing and think back to your work and think, well, there's something to this. So I'm really grateful to you for your persistence over many years. And one more thing you said in the intro I really liked when you, towards the end, you were talking about empathy and the getting right to the most, not controversial, but perhaps even confusing edge of those moments when you feel so empathically attuned to nature and even to what people call God, however you want to say it. And that's really very much at the heart of my work, and it's certainly also true that that can be some of the most controversial and for many people confusing. So there's a lot there.
Well, you know, the more I talk with folks from around the world who share my concerns about not using medications, not doing shock treatment, not locking up people, more and more I'm hearing folks who have a very spiritual concept of the universe, mm-hmm. that you're coming at this from a very caring and a very connected way. Can you talk a little about your own evolution? At what point did you begin to think, there's something more going on here than I originally thought in this life?
Sure. I actually grew up quite a devout atheist. I from a very young age, I thought that, you know, science was the key to everything. If we just got rid of religion, the world would be a happy place. And it was really a moment of reading a book. I won't go into detail. When I was 17, I had actually taken a year off from high school to study music full time. I was planning to go to conservatory. And I was learning music, piano and classical music and harmony and theory. And one day I sat down and read a book. And just in that moment, I knew that it wasn't about what religions had been saying. It was very much really about what you described in the opening, that there was this possibility of an experience of profound empathy with nature, with other people. And that from then on, it was just clear to me that's what life was about. And I actually had thought, right around that time, of switching from music psychology. This was in the early 70s, and all there was at that time was mostly behaviorism, and I think medication was beginning to make inroads at that time, more inroads, and I just couldn't see doing it. So I went through about 20 years as a professional composer and musician, performer, working with dancers, especially in New York City. And all through that time, I was looking, watching the field of psychology and watching what was happening as Buddhism was becoming very popular and all these alternative spiritualities. I was looking for where I could make an inroad. And finally, about 15 years into that career, I said, it's time. And I switched over into getting a master's in psychology and a PhD. But as you asked me before, at the same time, apart from my professional life, this sense of what this experience of profound empathy and profound connection and meaning could be was deepening in my life and becoming a more and more integral aspect of every part of my life, to the point, to jump to the present, where I've really gotten to the point where you mentioned the psychotherapy practice. I've almost come to feel that in order to bring a really deep sense of spirituality into the healing environment, it's really hard to do it in the present environment, where if you just mention the word therapy, you're already, if someone comes to you for therapy in most settings, there's this context where there's something wrong with them. There's something fundamentally wrong with them. And it's such hard work to get people past that idea that their identity is of being a depressed person or a bipolar person, to even start to get to touch a spiritual core, that I almost feel like there needs to be a whole different setting or structure or paradigm. And actually, to connect that to disability work, I found that outside of a therapy setting, just in a moment of intense, meaningful connection, you can actually bring, it's possible at times, to bring a really deep spiritual sense to someone to such an extent it can be healing. I'll give you an example. I've seen about 2,000 people in the past 7 years in the part-time work I do doing disability determinations in South Carolina. I'm sorry, disability evaluations. Now, I would say probably at least 15 or 20% of the people I've seen have been women who have been horrifically abused in both physical and sexual ways. Now, I do this in Greenville, South Carolina, which probably many people may know as the buckle of the Bible Belt. And I lived for most of my adult life in the East Village in New York City, which is, it's hard to imagine anywhere that's more the opposite. But one thing that's interesting about the two different places, in New York City, if you mention the word God, you can really cause a stir in the room. In Greenville, if you don't mention God, they think you're kind of strange. And it actually can be put to good use. It's kind of hard to do in the therapy setting where it's tricky to mention these kind of things. But I can have someone in front of me who is literally terrified in the beginning to be in the room with me and with anybody, but especially with a man. And if I can establish a rapport, at some point I'll often say something like, you grew up Baptist, didn't you? Yeah. And what do they teach you? Where is Jesus? What do they teach you? And they say, well, I don't know. And I'd say, well, I don't know. I always understood that Jesus was in our hearts. And we'd talk through it, and I'd say, what is it like to experience that? What does that mean to you? And if it's the right moment and if the right connection has been made, you can see literally physically this letting go and this sense of safety. And there's a sense of connection to the room that's so powerful. And they will often end up talking about things they never talked about before. And there's just a sense of, I've actually heard sometimes from people months later, even a couple of years later, that, they remember that experience of connection, of a spiritual connection, and something that they had never, a way of approaching spirituality they'd never experienced before.
And I think you're saying in particular they hadn't connected their psychological issues as they saw them with their spirituality, because that's my experience, is that in modern times people may be deeply religious, mm-hmm. or in a conventional sense, or they may have a profound sense of God in their lives,
right?
But they've been so conditioned to think psychologically and psychiatrically, mm-hmm. that when they're depressed or anxious or despairing or suicidal or feeling angry and hostile, they don't connect it to their spirituality as a doorway for them to heal themselves.
Exactly, yeah. And I'll bet, I have a question. I wonder if you found that particularly, well, in many cases, but what came to my mind was working with people who have PTSD, and I'm thinking of actually war veterans who've seen, you know, who've either killed or seen dearest friends killed. And it, they're either told that there's some sort of brain trace that occurred because of that, and they have to sort of change the brain chemistry, or it's connected to some the experience before in their life, and they have to sort of change their you know, schemas or ways of thinking, all those things. And what struck me, and I actually did my internship at the East Orange VA in New Jersey, so I found this occurring then. And I find it, occasionally I'll get a veteran, a Vietnam, Iraq War veteran. I just saw a guy, I'll try to not say anything too specific, but he was stationed in Korea. And this was some years ago, and he had to kill somebody. And in the process, the body was so distorted. What happened to the body was horrific. And he had to go across the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, and bring the body back. And this has stuck with him for more than a quarter century. And if you leave behind the sort of biological, the psychiatric, or even the psychological, and say, what place in him, what deep, deep place in him has been torn apart by having to kill, by, this is a young man, he was in his late teens or maybe 20, had never been involved in any kind of military, very little training before that, and suddenly he's thrown against the ultimate issue for a human being of life and death. And my sense is that his sense of himself was so torn apart that when that happens, when our belief system of who we are as moral people or as good people or what we're trained to do, when that's all torn apart, you have what is, on the one hand, a desperate trauma, but on the other hand, you have this opportunity, you have this profound moment where there's this vacuum, this emptiness, that can connect you with something that you've never conceived of before. And after we talked for about 2 hours. I usually see someone for 45 minutes. We talked about 2 hours, and towards the end, he was crying through. This is a really, you know, someone you look at on the street, this is a tough guy, big tough guy. He was crying, and he was talking about how what he had lost, he'd grown up as a very devout Catholic, what he lost was his connection to God, and that was the thing that was most dramatic to him. And he talked about attempting over the years, you know, without much success, attempting to get back that. What that was about for him was not about, primarily about a brain change or about a psychological issue. It was about trying to get back to that sense of connection, what you were talking about at the beginning.
Yeah. I think that, Don, by the way, you're listening to Donald Salmon. Do you pronounce it salmon or salmon?
Salmon like the fish, yeah.
And it's S-A-L-M-O-N, and I'll give your email or some other contact. What would you like?
You can give my website, which is yoga-psychology.com.
yoga-psychology.com. And you're still in Greenville, South Carolina?
No, we actually just moved.
You moved, I thought.
A few weeks
yes.
ago to Asheville, North Carolina.
To Asheville, North Carolina. A wonderful place to live. I think you're going to find a lot of spirituality there as well as in Greenville. Maybe some greater sophistication. Maybe not.
Love,
I mean, it's going to be interesting to talk to you again about that.
Yes, yes.
But let me keep addressing what you're talking about because I think this is just so incredibly important. And if you've just tuned in, this is, of course, the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. Many people who have been through very traumatic experiences end up growing with them and viewing them as their gateways to spirituality. Barbara and Charles Whitfield, who've written extensively about trauma, believe very strongly that it often opens up for people a special awareness, a special sensitivity to the world. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, I have my own experiences. I usually end up concluding I don't know why some people are more open, more loving, more empathic, more reaching than others. It often seems to start in childhood. But certainly your description, your really wonderful and vivid description, is something for us all to keep in mind, for all therapists to keep in mind. I'm very, very direct on with the people I deal with as a psychiatrist and a therapist. And I tell people, you have a normal brain, you're a normal person, you're dealing with your life circumstances as best as you can. Now let's figure out, you know, how you can do it even better, and how the way you've dealt with these experiences might be improved in the future for yourself.
I think that's great.
But never think of yourself as being abnormal or having an abnormal brain, because mm-hmm. that's not what's going on.
Right.
And for some people, of course, for some soldiers who are returning from active duty, they do have a degree of traumatic brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, the principles of healing don't change.
Right.
Especially if your brain's been compromised by an injury, you want to stay away from toxic psychiatric drugs. The first thing, if you've gotten a head injury, and the principles of self-empowerment and spirituality and making the most of your life are the same. They're unchanged. And I think they're universal, and they're not determined by our circumstances or even by our biology. These are almost timeless. They may be timeless kinds of issues.
Can I adjust?
Now you become a meditation teacher over the years.
What you said, this is actually related to meditation. What you said about, you know, whether people have a normal brain and obviously there are traumatic brain injuries. But let me just address that, and for both from my understanding and from my experience with working with patients. In terms of my understanding, I would imagine you and your listeners have heard about neuroplasticity, and with every year, every month that goes by, the research is showing that the brain is far more plastic than we thought. And in fact, it seems like if you heard that 30 years ago when a lot of the research really got off the ground, you'd have to say, we know it's 100 times more plastic than we thought 30 years ago. So I'll give you a specific example. When I started a neuropsychology rotation in my internship, I told this story about someone I worked with briefly who had multiple sclerosis. She had not been able to write. Her hands were so stiff, she couldn't write for 3 years. And as you, I'm sure you know the brain better than I do, but MS involves the demyelination. In other words, help me out here, the neurons cannot transmit as well with MS. And when I told the story, the neuropsychology professor said, oh, well, this must have happened over 3 months because that's how long it takes so-and-so. I didn't say anything. I didn't want to create a controversy, but here's what happened. I was spent a year in the mid-90s using meditation to help people in physical pain. And, by the way, during that year, I got people off medication for depression, insomnia, and in one case, it just happened. Someone came in one day and said, I've been teaching him breathing. He said, oh, I haven't used my inhaler for 6 months. I threw away most of them. I keep one in hand for emergencies. So, everyone, this can be done. But in this one case, this woman, she's about 29, she had not been able to write. Her hands were so stiff for 3 years. Now, my thought went to my experience as a piano player, and I know what it involves. You know, I've had to, like, play the piano, and my hands were freezing cold, and I know that with deep attunement and deep meditation, you can raise the temperature of your hands. So I thought, well, you know, I'll give it a shot. I don't know what will happen. So I had her do an exercise where she was sensitizing her hands and had her really concentrate deeply. And I was watching her face very, very carefully. And at one moment I could see something let go. I said, take a pen. She grabbed a pen and she started writing. And she just broke down crying. And I think we need to be, you know, responsible scientists and acknowledge that what we know, that the, you know, a traumatized brain can't affect us, but I think we also need to be open and say, you know what? I believe it was Robert Sapolsky, one of the greatest brain scientists in the world. I read a quote about a year ago. He said, we don't know anything about the brain by comparison. You know, we really know so little. And I think when we have these possibilities, we have the possibilities of regeneration of the brain, we should honor what we know of the science, but I think we need to be open to, my God, there's so many possibilities we hardly even imagined.
Well, yes, I strongly agree with you, Don. And it goes two ways. I mean, we know so little about the brain that to claim a psychiatric drug is fixing it is foolhardy and fraudulent.
Right.
The brain is so complex, and these drugs are so gross and toxic that all psychiatric drugs can do is disable the brain. And, you know, that's why my major text that I've written, I call Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, because they all disable this incredibly complex, subtle, intricate system that we hardly know a thing about. One of the things we know is that psychoactive substances don't help the brain. They always confound the processes that are already going on in the brain. So you're doing more and more meditation classes now and less therapy, or you're combining them? How are you working?
I'm doing a lot less. Actually, I've stopped doing therapy the last couple of years and focusing much more on meditation. And my wife and I are now devoting a lot of our time. We're working together, and we're developing online courses. We're working on one right now for meditation and actually for, in the treatment of physical pain. And we're going to be developing, this is really fun because it brings together my music and psychology, some music and animation videos just detailing a really different way of looking at science, of bringing in spirituality into all areas of science, particularly in psychology. And actually, let me bring together this with something you asked about before, back to PTSD and meditation. My wife and I spent about 6 years full-time writing a book on yoga psychology. And a lot of it's very research-oriented and very, you know, somewhat academic, but we wanted to have some stories woven through the book for people to really relate to it, to empathize with. And what I did was I took several people that I worked with on my internship, VA internship, all of whom had been diagnosed with PTSD, and all of whom had inspired me because with each person, they had had some clear spiritual breakthrough. That was part of, or there was some spiritual question at the core of their trauma. So in the book, I have a composite person we named Sharon, and it's all based on real life experiences, but what happened to Sharon, again, this is based on real life, is she, was a medic in Vietnam, and she had seen what was the most traumatizing thing for her. She kept talking about how every day these trucks filled with dead bodies would come into the compound. And it just seeing this day after day for months at a time got to the point where when she came back home, nothing was the same. Everything, she had been a brilliant, idealistic child. She was ready to come back. She grew up in a very poor community. She was going to come back and work with the people in her community as a doctor, and she couldn't be a doctor anymore. She couldn't do this anymore. And she did a number of different things until finally she fell apart and she ended up in a hospital on the verge of killing herself. And the thing that struck me about just after I saw her just after she was released from the hospital. And she said, you know what I did? Every day I go out to the grounds of this beautiful tree and I would sit in the bench and I used to call it the tree at the end of the earth, because whenever I sat at that tree, I just felt peace. And I said, this just came to me. I said, where is that tree now? He said, well, what do you mean? I said, where is the tree now? It just got quiet. And we sat there, I think, 10, 15 minutes, just in silence. And she just got this look of peace and quiet over her face. I worked with her for 9 months, and the entire therapy consisted of connecting that, quote unquote, that tree with the people she knew, with her family, with her relationships, with her attempts to get back to work. And now in the book.
Don, we're going to go to break now. I think this is an excellent time to go to break. You're listening to Donald Salmon from Asheville, North Carolina now, psychologist, meditation teacher, works with his wife in teaching meditation and a spirit, combining really the spirituality, creativity, and therapy.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files. And it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down, or you're just curious, be sure to listen in, Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
The Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, carolee@garynoll.com. That's K-A-R-A-L-E-E @garynoll.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour. My guest today and for the full hour is Don Salmon. Talking to someone like Don brings many, many things to mind. But one of the things that I want to remind you about is that if you want to meet a lot of wonderful, wonderful people, get involved with our organization, the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living, empathictherapy.org. I think that's how Don originally got in contact with us, through empathictherapy.org. And in April, we'll be holding a national conference in Syracuse, New York, April 8th, 9th, and 10th. And we're going to have a lot of wonderful folks there talking about issues very much like the ones Don and I are addressing today, as well as a whole variety. We'll have people talking about stress and war. We'll have people talking about child abuse. We'll have people talking about how they lost children and family members to psychiatric drugs. And we'll have many people talking about therapeutic alternatives. Some folks will be very secular in their orientation, and others are going to have a chance to talk about their true spiritual feelings, which folks often don't get to do at a conference. So stay in touch with us at empathictherapy.org. Talking with Don reminded me of something that I haven't talked about previously on the shows, which is the concept of a healing presence. In my book, The Heart of Being Helpful, I searched to find the kind of words to describe the state of mind, the spiritual state of someone who's going to be healing people. And I think it begins with a healing presence. Now, it's very hard to define that. It involves a welcoming attitude toward the other human being. It involves a treasuring of the other person's thoughts and feelings and a welcoming of that person. It involves a peacefulness in yourself where you don't have an emergency when the other person feels like they are having an emergency. So the folks come to us for help. They may be feeling violent or suicidal or despairing or overwhelmed with anxiety. And it's the task of the healer, the helper, the therapist. And I think Don will say, and be interesting to hear, the meditation teacher, to be so comfortable within himself or herself that that outside emergency doesn't cause an internal emergency in the therapist. Now, in psychiatry, as it's routinely practiced today, you go to the psychiatrist and you say, I'm feeling suicidal, and the psychiatrist has an emergency. And the psychiatrist has to drug you. The psychiatrist may even lock you up against your will. And it's the very opposite of what the person in a psychological or a psychospiritual emergency needs to hear. What they need to hear is, oh, okay. I've been there before. That's something that you can be helped with. In fact, why don't we just talk a bit? You may start feeling better pretty quick. You want to have that kind of concept inside you of the strength of a healing presence. And with that, let me invite back on the show Don Salmon from Asheville, North Carolina.
Thank you. You know, I was thinking of you were telling that, just trying to describe the healing presence that I'm sure I would imagine you've experienced this too, but I know when I am in that emergency place myself, if I'm feeling out of touch and feeling anxious, very anxious for the person I'm with, it's just going to trigger more anxiety more in them. And it can be really hard work. I hope I haven't been too glib in describing some of my successes, because I can tell you, you know, when you're with someone, and I have to say, I've worked in psychiatric hospitals, I don't think I've ever seen people who are going through such difficulty as I've seen with some of the people in the disability evaluations. And I see people who have not left their homes in 4 or 5 months and had to be encouraged by their whole family for days just to get out to the appointment. And they are there shaking and the whole time. And I know in the beginning, I may be nervous with them. I'd be shaking with them, you know, and sometimes I'll tell, you know, talk about healing presence. Yeah, this is a tough one. When I get the material from the state or from an attorney, I work for both, and I see the history of intense physical and sexual abuse, I know that woman is going to sit there in front of me, and I often will tell them, hey, I'm psychic. I can tell what you're thinking. You are thinking, I ain't going to say nothing to you, and this is the last place in the world I want to be. I want to be anywhere but here. And what I started doing, I set my watch for a half hour. I said, you know what? I'm pretty good. I said, I have some failures, but I'll tell you, when this watch rings in a half hour, you're going to be there telling me things you never told anyone before. And I fail, and I am sweating bullets sometimes the first 15, 20 minutes, because I know this person is in agony, doesn't want to be there, probably so that she hates me. And it's up to me to try to find a place in myself that can allow her to feel safe. So it's hard work, that healing presence.
Well, it's especially hard work, I think, if you're trying to do disability determinations, because, as you said, the person doesn't want to be there. So the person's really almost involuntary. Mm-hmm. They have to see you and talk to you or to someone like you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very stressful for everyone involved. And I admire your stick-to-itiveness in doing it. I actually, as an experiment, because just hadn't done it before, I did one disability examination about a year ago, and I'll never do another one again. Not because of the individual, but because of this complex network of people vying for that person's soul. The insurance company wants to show that that this person's a faker. If you're involved with the person and caring about them, you want to let people know that there's some genuine suffering going on. Oh, gosh. So I admire you doing it, and I think to be able to help anyone in that setting is no easy task. I much prefer folks who are coming to me, as I'm sure your meditation and your therapy clients come to you, you know, seeking voluntarily your help.
Right.
And I don't think you were being glib. I think it's wonderful that you're communicating to people that, by the way, I wouldn't want to be sweating bullets as in my work, and that's probably one of the reasons I don't do disability determinations. I want to feel a real comfort and feel that that I know that, that things are just going to go okay if if I can sit with this other human being for a while.
Right.
And that's
right.
No, so much easier to do in a voluntary therapy setting, obviously.
Well, talk about setting. Let me plug your organization for a minute, because I had a very positive experience with it, and two other things related to that. One, yeah, as you had said to the audience earlier, I did come to you through that website. I encourage anyone out there to go to empathictherapy.org. I was very impressed with there. I've been writing back and forth. I wrote a couple little articles for the newsletter up there, and I just think it's a wonderful thing you're doing.
It's a free newsletter. A free newsletter.
Yes, yes. And the second thing I mentioned before, that I stopped doing psychotherapy, and gosh, this is related to disability too, that I've been feeling more and more the last few years that the context, the community in which we live, is in a way one of the most powerful means of potential, either means of disease or healing. And you're right. I get people, in terms of how the community can be disempowering and causing illness, I work both for the state and for attorneys. I have, you know, the state, their aim is to disallow people. And I shouldn't be quoted on the radio saying that. Anyway, it's very, pretend I didn't say that, radio people. It's very hard. The government makes it very hard to get disability. Now, I have actually seen a 21-year-old man in a wheelchair who had two strokes and couldn't speak, who had been turned down, and this is not entirely atypical. And furthermore, it's even worse, because as a therapist, I would like to say, you know, if we had a really functional mental health system, a lot of the people wouldn't need to be applying for disability. They could be cured. So on the positive side, a few days after I moved to Asheville, I came across this community. I want to tell you about it, because I think it might be really nice for you to connect with this organization. And if people around the country have any possibility of creating this in their community, this is so positive. There's a place called the Cooper Reese Healing Community. That's Cooper Reese, one word, and it's R-I-I-S. And it's cooperreese.org. And let me read two sentences, because it sounds like Dr. Peter Bregan wrote this. This is just outside of Asheville, and their focus, it's about 80 people they have there for, well, I think it's a one-month on-site place in a very beautiful natural environment. It's called Relationship-Centered Care. Two sentences. Within the Cooper Reese Healing Community, we practice relationship-centered care. What this means is that all interactions, wherever and whatever the moment, however routine or special, are based on a fundamental commitment to mutual respect, self-awareness, humility, openness, and caring. And they have a full complement of everything from nutrition, physical exercise, recreation, cultural, artistic experiences, psychotherapy. They do have psychopharmacology when needed. And I think from what I get from the site, they don't need it much. And I'm bringing this up because the last session of psychotherapy I did about 4 years ago, I realized that what I really want to do, and what personally means the most to me, is find some way to encourage communities at large, which I think in this you know, in the midst of the economic crisis we're experiencing, to really focus on what people can do, everyone, not just people who are quote-unquote mentally ill or mentally challenged, what we can do, every one of us, and not people who are necessarily have big organizations or big places in the government, can do to help make all of our communities healing communities. And in terms of teaching meditation, once Jan and I, Jan is my wife, once we had begin to have a number of online courses and courses we can sort of give out in digital format, what we want to do is go to some prisons, go to some retirement communities, go to hospitals and say, look, you know, you don't need to pay a fortune for this. This is a very simple thing. If you want us to come and come to your prison or come to your hospital and talk about how the staff can use this, how the patients can use this, and they can, and we can, we don't need to have an ongoing training. We can come there once or twice and teach people how to use this to empower themselves and to heal themselves in the context of a healing community. That's what really excites us right now.
Well, I really, really wish you well with that. And one of the things that my wife Ginger and I are most concerned about is providing particularly residential alternatives, and if not residential, at least a daycare alternatives that are drug-free.
Right.
I hope the group you're working with, or if you're going to get to know them, the Cooper Reese, I hope they'll go drug-free. I hope they'll face the real issue here. Because essentially, when you give out a psychiatric drug to just a small number of people, you're actually just deciding who deserves to be poisoned. And I just don't think that that kind of triage is what we need to really help other human beings. Because as soon as you whip out the drug and you say, oh, you're the one we're going to give the medication to, you give that person the message that you're the one we actually can't help through our caring relationship therapy. And for that reason, I think that medication-free treatment, which is what I've been doing my entire career, is by far and away the best alternative, because it communicates to the person that you can be reached, you can be helped. You're not different from other folks. You're not in some way medically incorrigible or medically damaged. Let me tell people again that you're listening to Donald Salmon, who from North Carolina, from Asheville. And why don't you give your website again?
Okay, it's yoga-psychology.com. And if you'd like, it's very simple. We're just starting to put up the videos, but if you search on YouTube for Beyond the Matrix, The Only Way Out, one of our videos is up there with music, and may enjoy that. It's focused on what it means to really take seriously the idea that life has a spiritual basis.
Let me just sort of throw the mic open to you, Don and Sister, and just ask you to, you know, what's the thing you most want to communicate to folks? You're very articulate. You're doing a really nice job today. Expressing what you believe and what you do. Just tell us some more about it.
Sure. Okay. I'll go to the edge of controversy. Let's see. What Jan and I, Jan, my wife, and I have been most passionate about in the 17 years we've been together, and for me, for the last 35 years of my life, has been developing the spiritual psychology of it's an Indian philosopher and poet who lived in the 20th century. His name is Sri Aurobindo. And the book that we wrote, Yoga Psychology and the Transformation of Consciousness, is based on his work. And the book is in a way in two parts. The first part, we tried very hard to make this a non-New Agey, a very solid science-based as much as we could, but it's the first part is a challenge. It's about the short part, it's about 70 pages. It's really directing, you know, challenging people to ask, what is our consciousness? What is our brain? I'm hesitate to mention evolution because everyone's going to think of intelligent design, but this is completely different from that. Just questioning, is it possible that mind or consciousness or intelligence of any kind could have any effect in, I'll say in the course of evolution, again, I'm harsh with that word. Anyway, that was all a prelude, that first part of the book, to introducing Sri Aurobindo's more spiritual psychology. Now, what we've done, we've given talks in different places, we've talked to many people about this online, we've talked in here in this country, in India, we've given presentations in India, and what we find is that whether people, you know, quote-unquote, believe in this stuff or they're total skeptics, what keeps getting in the way is the assumption that in order to be science, in order to be grounded, in order to be a rational, intelligent, clear-thinking person in this world, you need to really accept the hard facts that, you know, all the spiritual stuff may be nice, you can have a nice, empathic, attuned feeling of nature, but it's really, there's no ultimate purpose and meaning in the universe. And this, all this stuff about spirit and consciousness is all kind of a thing that we've made up. So what we're, apart from the meditation and pain management programs we're developing, what we're really focusing on, and this is our real passion right now, it's probably going to take a few years, we're going to really focus on this, is to, and we hope we can learn to do it playfully and not just kind of this knock people over the head challenge, to really get people just to, not to believe anything, but really get people to question, really question, what is this all based on? What is this all about? What is this world of objects in front of us? Is it really what we believe? You can stop me. This can get very, very far out and it can sound too woo-woo, but we go through a lot of research and a lot of different science and great stories in the opening section of the book, and we're going to try to learn through music videos and through different ways of talking and teaching meditation classes to invite people to think really differently about this stuff.
Now, tell me, how does this inspire people to live better, happier, fuller lives? Make that connection.
Yeah.
What you're doing actually elevates the human experience.
I'll connect it right with your work. When someone comes to me or comes to you and says, you know, what I need, listen, I got to have an antidepressant because the reason I feel bad is because I got this chemical imbalance in my brain. Okay? So, how is it possible? Why is it so easy to sell to people? Why do people so readily believe this? Well, if I believe that if I'm feeling that my life, I don't feel a connection, and I'm feeling down in my life, and I may be functioning, quote-unquote, well, but I just don't feel like I'm living life to the fullest. And I think, well, hey, you know, I got this brain thing. I can't do anything about it. This is profoundly disempowering. And I think, actually, to me, you know, not everyone may feel this way, if I come back to you and say, you know, Dr. Reagan, I was out in the woods the other day. I was sitting by a lake, and I'm an atheist. I don't believe in this stuff, but I just felt this sense of profound meaning. I was looking at the light glittering off the water, and it just felt like a new dimension opened to me. And if you say to me, well, you know, boy, you know, I'll tell you, they've discovered that the prefrontal cortex, when it's activating, and you get to the left temporal cortex, that actually activates a certain set of chemicals in the body, and that's why you feel this way. Well, that's very popular now. Actually, even in the Buddhist field, in neuroscience, people are saying, oh, that's exciting. Now I know why I feel this way. Whereas, if...
By the way, that's all fake science, basically. We can get into that in some more detail, but...
We don't
have the faintest idea how the brain operates.
Exactly.
It's absurd.
But if I can even consider that there is something about what my life is about, that something about what I have an urge to help other people, to serve people, to create a better world, is that just synapses in my brain? Is that just my conditioning? Or is there something, I won't even put words to it, is there something that is in all of us that is urging us to that? Well, to me, that, speaking personally, that makes life an incredible adventure, incredibly rich, and it makes me, you know, look forward to getting up in the morning and trying to find some way, new ways to communicate that.
You're listening to my guest. This is Peter Breggin, a hard-nosed scientific psychiatrist with a strong spiritual bent. You're listening to my guest, Don Salmon, Dr. Salmon, PhD, in Asheville, North Carolina. And one last time, Don, give your identification and how people can get you, and then I will be finishing up with a few minutes commentary. So let folks know how they can get in touch with you.
Sure. You're welcome to write me at Don Salmon, it's all one word, donsalmon7@gmail.com. I love to argue, so if you think the spiritual stuff is nonsense, please write me. I'd love to hear. Our book is Yoga Psychology and the Transformation of Consciousness, Seeing Through the Eyes of Infinity. It's available on Amazon. And our website is yoga-psychology.com.
Don Salmon, thank you so, so much for being on my show today.
It's been an honor. I really appreciate it.
Your manner is wonderful, and I think your insights are tremendous.
Thank you. I really appreciate your asking me on. It's been an honor.
Well, we will talk again, and we will get to know each other better, I'm sure, over time. You know, a little bit earlier in the show, Don touched on this whole issue of intelligence being active in history. And some of you know that the most recent book I've written is called Wow, I'm an American, How to Live Like Our Nation's Heroic Founders. And when I studied the lives of George Washington and Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and Samuel Adams and John Adams and others who were the great founders of our country, I was very surprised, indeed shocked, to learn that, contrary to what I'd been taught, every one of them believed in God, and every one of them believed that God was active in human life, and every one of them believed that we wouldn't have won the revolution, and in the case of Madison, that we wouldn't have even had the Constitution created out of the Tower of Babel of folks at the Constitutional Convention if it hadn't been for some divine intervention. Now, this is pretty basic Judeo-Christian spirituality, and a lot of Old Testament concepts of God giving freedom to the Jews and then freedom to all of humanity, granting them the right to freedom. Very, very basic to the founding of this nation. So anyone who is an American and benefits from this marvelous country and belongs to our history should feel comfortable believing and knowing that this nation was founded by people who believed that God intervenes in human life. Now, when I was a young man, like our guest Don Salmon, I was, well, not an atheist, but an agnostic. And these ideas have only come to me later in life. But I can tell you now, as I look at my life, as I look at the gift of my partnership with Ginger Breggin, as I look at the things I've been allowed to do, the life I've been permitted to lead, I cannot explain it other than that I've been blessed. And I welcome you to accept that or not accept that. Goodness knows not all of my friends do, and certainly for many of the patients or clients that I help, that's not a part of their understanding of life. But I can tell you that it's hard for me to make any intelligent sense out of life without sensing that there's an intelligent aspect in this universe that's beyond our intelligence, beyond our spiritual knowledge, but manifested everywhere we look. And I've never said that aloud so clearly before on radio, and I thank Don Salmon, my guest, for encouraging me with his own spiritual insights and understanding. So I don't come from a Buddhist or a Hindu or an Eastern tradition, although I've read and I'm sure in some ways been influenced by it, but I come from a very strong Judeo-Christian tradition as a Jew who's been influenced by the whole of the Judeo Christian tradition. And I believe that empathy is at the heart of the Judeo-Christian tradition, the love your neighbor as yourself, is at the heart of everything that's good. And if you do, and by the way, our founders believed this profoundly. They said it again and again, that liberty was about loving your neighbor as you love yourself, and that taking responsibility was about accepting our place in the plan, where we are supposed to take responsibility for ourselves and contribute to others, contribute to society. That there's a web here of empathy and social responsibility and God that deeply influenced the founders. And it's good for us to openly be able to talk about this gift of life. You're listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. I hope it's been a really interesting hour for you and a stimulating hour for you. You don't have to have any set belief to be a part of our empathic therapy organization. So see you at empathictherapy.org. Goodbye.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.